a shot in the dark. Where he sort of spark. I'm a light that's too bright for me to see.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, kids, here we go. Episode, what is this, like 276, I think? I've lost count of how many episodes I've done, and I am completely amazed I've done 276 of anything. So we have a really nice surprise today. I was setting up gear to record, and Paul McCusker walked into the – I did it. I used a G. Paul McCusker walked into the room, and we started talking about some stuff while I was setting up, and I decided this is a show. Let's just talk for a while. So I think we only have him for a segment or two because Mass is coming up, and I'm going to record through Mass because I'm a bad Catholic. So welcome back to Paul McCusker.
Thank you. Good to be back spontaneously.
Yeah, that's fun. I like whenever I had some spontaneous interviews on Friday. I was fishing for them though. I purposely set up my gear before this reading group that I was going to be in, knowing the interesting people would come. They didn't all come to the last minute, so the last minute just like turned into like this cavalcade of like, "Hey, look who it is!" You know. All right, so Paul and I were talking about what decent, thoughtful human beings who happen to be Catholic could try to make of A, Trump, B, what's going on, C, how everyone on both sides is reacting, and what do you think, Paul?
Well, I mean, the funny thing is I tend to give any president the benefit of the doubt until they prove to me that I shouldn't be giving them the benefit of the doubt. So my view is I'm just watching what he does and watch the checks and balances that are in place, where he's stepping over the mark and where he's not, but mostly giving him time to settle in and figure things out because he's not a politician. I mean, he kind of threw himself into this. He's a businessman. Clearly, a lot of what he's doing and how he is annoying people is because he's a businessman and he's using business principles and how he haggles and negotiates the bluff and bluster of the first strike, and then you react to that, and then we'll come to a sensible conclusion.
Right.
And on down the line.
I mean, look at what he did with Mexico. We're gonna build this wall, we're gonna make Mexico pay for it.
Yeah.
And then Mexico freaks out, cancels something, he floats something over here. And it turns out that they're gonna build this wall, if they ever build it. They're going to impose, he's wanting to impose a tax.
Yeah.
And then we're going to be the ones that ends up actually paying for it by buying canned frijoles from Mexico that have been taxed.
But if it even comes to that, I mean, the thing is, there's that dynamic with him that's a constant, it's a constant haggling that's going on.
Right.
And so for me, watching him, I'm thinking, well, I'm not going to react until it is what it really is.
Right. Yeah.
All of the very transparent way that he keeps throwing out ideas and comments and it's going to be this or it's going to be that, it doesn't mean anything.
Well, you
get right down to it.
You had a great comparison. He's beta testing.
Yeah, constantly. And it's funny. And as we said, I mean, we were talking about the fact that when Obamacare went out, it was like a big beta test. And it had problems and had glitches, and they're still working through lots of it. And that's one reason why it may get overturned or repaired or replaced or whatever they're going to do with it. But he's doing it on the other side. The difference is people don't seem to be giving him the benefit of the doubt.
Well, I think that, they weren't giving the benefit of doubt. And then all of a sudden, he signed this executive order. Saying that people from these certain countries that are of this certain, set of circumstances can't come in for 90 days, I think it was.
Right.
And people, I have seen in the Catholic world, I have seen everything from either you're pro Trump and you support whatever he does, but he's helping us stop the killing of babies. And you're satanic if you don't. Mm-hmm. And you're a Pharisee if you say that you're a Catholic and you don't do that. Simca Fisher wrote an article saying that this is a new Kristallnacht.
Mm-hmm.
That this basically, he's publishing these names and we're preparing for basically, this is Hitler part two. This is another Holocaust. I'm seeing everything on the Catholic side from both sides of this. Mm. And I don't know, I guess I ask myself, I just can't, I don't feel like I understand the context of it and the big picture of it enough to form an opinion to kind of rally in the street or attack anyone over it, you know?
Well, I think, again, watching and waiting rather than reacting to him, because there's always something to react to. I'm not sure about the all or nothing mentality in either direction.
Right.
You're either all in favor of him and will not harbor any criticism of him, or you're on the other side where you absolutely hate him and you will harbor no compliment of him.
Right.
You know, it's this all or nothing scares me, especially for Christians. And one of the things I keep thinking about, it's like football.
Yeah, it is.
It's like, this is my team. And you know what? I can't even betray. I'm going to acknowledge the quarterback.
It's more
a little
like
bit
professional
of an
wrestling.
Well, actually, it is. It's a like, SmackDown. Well, and admittedly, Trump turned it into a bit of a reality TV.
Well, and
SmackDown,
he floated Vince McMahon as a possible running mate at one point.
But I think the
he's
all
been
or nothing.
On there.
We are so polarized. The all or nothing comes from this sensibility that I dare not concede a fault or an error or anything like that, because my adversaries will use that
right
against me, because everything's PR right now. You're playing for the team and you're taking it for the team. You're doing whatever, whichever team you're on, which of course, the only team that I'm technically part of is, well, the Catholic Church. And the only one that my allegiance goes to is Jesus Christ himself. Everybody right. else is fair game for me to say, well, there's some things I don't necessarily like Trump's personality. I spend a lot of time trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I'm not a Trump fan, but I'm in favor of a lot of the things that he's trying to do. I may not like everything that he tries to do, but right. turning him into Hitler, that's as silly to me as trying to say that Obama was. I
right.
mean, both of them were determined to do what they set out to do.
Right.
And it depends on which side of the ideological line you fall on, whether you know whether he's the savior or whether he's the Antichrist. I mean, really, when it comes to politicians and leaders like that, I don't think of them that way. It's not all or nothing for me.
Right.
Obama did some good things,
mm-hmm.
And then he did things that I abhorred. Trump may do some good. I mean, the man's only been in office, what, 10 days?
Right, and I think that people didn't read this executive order.
Yeah.
And they didn't understand the scope of what it was. And I think, I think this might be underplaying a little bit, but as I was telling you, one of my friends who's not a Catholic and who's not even a Republican, not a conservative, but I guess he just got sick of everyone protesting all over the place. And he put on right. his Facebook page that we have to ask ourselves, do we want to live in a country where dozens of people can be temporarily inconvenienced? And it's like, I mean, it really wasn't that many people that got caught in it. There was a question about whether or not green card holders had all right. that. And we're going to redo the rules for vetting, because there's been some people who have come in who have done terrorist acts and they looked good and they got through. So we're going to, you know, until we kind of do that, we're just going to shut this down for a little while. That's how he's pushing it.
Right.
Now, when you combine that with, like, you know, Steve Bannon whispering in his ear and kind of the specter of the alt-right kind of through that, and he's publishing when he says he's going to publish lists of crimes committed by illegal aliens in these sanctuary cities to kind of shame them into letting him kind of take care of the sanctuary city. That's why people are starting to say that it's starting to look very, very xenophobic.
Now, are these the same people who didn't get upset over publishing the names of those people in California who voted for Prop 8?
Right, yeah.
I
remember that.
We're going to publish the names of people who voted for Prop 8, and we are going to drive them out of business.
I got in the middle of that because one of my employees gave money to Prop 8,
mm-hmm.
and I was listed on that list because I was listed as her employer.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I felt really targeted.
Yeah.
You know,
Yeah, and it's a lot of it's posturing. A lot of it is trying to give the illusion of being active. I mean, that's the danger with government. It always worries me when government does anything quickly, only because they usually like to be seen as doing something, whether it's effective or not.
Right.
So, as I understand it, the president kind of threw this executive order out there, no heads up to Homeland
right.
Security. They were confused about what the rules were, and nobody did the 1,000 page document to tell them exactly what to do in what situation.
Right.
So we had a couple of days of confusion. He was beta testing, as I said.
Right. Yeah. He doesn't seem to feel that he owes anyone. He sees himself as someone who's not the government, brought into the government
to kind of
put the government in its place. And so because of that, he doesn't feel like he owes anybody any warning or any insight.
Yeah.
As long as, if you work for the government, then I don't owe you anything.
Well, it's more than that.
But you're now the leader of the government.
Right.
So you can't just make these rules and then you end up with some family of five trying to come see grandma that had their visas cleared and now they can't leave JFK. I mean, that's just pretty sketchy.
And it's hard. And it like a lot of the trouble in the business world, you have these troubleshooter presidents that they'll put into companies that are in trouble. And they basically come in and do that exact thing. They kind of go to the draconian activities and rules, and we're cutting this and we're throwing away that, and we're going to cut the budget by this much. And the effect of that gets worked out and modified as they do it. But first thing is, I need to do something.
Right.
So you're absolutely right. I mean, the reality is, when human lives are involved, you shouldn't be beta testing.
Well, and I think we're up towards the end of the break, but the best thing I've seen so far, I love watching Facebook as a metric for this stuff and how people are reacting, is a couple I know were sitting and watching the Miss Universe pageant last night, and this guy was reeling about how these people ought to let us build a wall, and then Miss Mexico walks out on stage and he goes, why are we building a wall again? And he got smacked pretty good for that. Well, we're going to head off to the break. We got a few more minutes. Maybe we can talk Paul into staying for a minute or two afterwards, but we got to get him off the mask. He can't be a pagan like me and work through mask. All right, you're listening to The Counterposition. I am your host, Andrew Whaley.
Let my sacred word to mutter. Ran too fast and turned to butter. I'm a bit too much for me to chew.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counterposition, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
Let me skip across the pond. I'm an ocean on and on. I'm a fish with no bowl that I outgrew. Lift my blood. See only one on track.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, so we've coaxed Paul McCusker into another few minutes of conversation. So, Paul, what I've been thinking about is, you know, it's funny. There's this book by Victor Davis Hanson called Who Killed Homer? And it was about what we've lost by taking the Greeks and Romans and classical studies out of our education, kind of the core of our education process. And one of those things that you learn from Homer and from the Greeks is that culture is not blood.
Mm-hmm.
And blood is not culture. And everybody from Hitler to La Raza got that wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but then there's also the flip side of that is that, but now that it's not blood, what is it? What is culture and citizenship and the concept of being a citizen in a state is a really old, really important concept in the West.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess that's what I've been thinking about is, are we losing both? Are we throwing the baby out with the bathwater and getting kind of a little tacitly xenophobic and talking about like, we can't let these people come here because they're going to affect our culture. And then on the other hand, it's like, the other side is like, no, citizenship means nothing, you know?
And it's, well, and that's the problem with the extremes. And even how you just said that is indicative of something. Because number one, I've not heard Trump say he's not going to let people in.
Right.
The idea of having secure borders to me is the same as having a lock on my front door.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea that not everybody is going to come in whenever they want to because they want to. I think even diehard liberals have locks on their doors because they don't let everybody just come in whenever people want to walk into their house.
And we used to live in a neighborhood where we could leave our doors unlocked.
Right.
America just isn't in a neighborhood anymore.
Yeah. I mean, what we have to figure out is the legitimacy of a threat. I mean, if I have two doors down from me, guys that I know or have a meth lab in their house, which, right. if nothing else, apart from any horror I might have about what meth does to people, mm-hmm. but the fact that it could blow up and take up our cul-de-sac with it. Well, there are things that I may do to preempt the – and what I hope – I worry is an inevitable conclusion about right. this thing blowing up. So when we talk about how we vet people who come into the country
right.
and the means by which we do that and being careful and a bit guarded, I don't think it's culture. I think it's just safety. We're just saying we don't want to allow people in who have sworn that they're going to come in and destroy us, given
right.
the chance.
Well, there's two different issues here. There's refugees from these Middle Eastern countries where terrorism, and then we've got the border wall with Mexico. I think that if we shut the border down completely and build a big fat wall, mm-hmm. and we don't couple that with, like, I just heard a great article on NPR about the dairy industry.
Mm-hmm.
There are no agricultural work visas for the dairy industry, and yet 90% of the people who are willing to do really hard backbreaking labor that happens in dairies are from Mexico. Mm-hmm. Or from Central America somewhere. But there's no way for someone to legally come here and do this job, but milk prices are set mm-hmm. and limited by the government.
Right.
And so there's no, you've got a situation where it's like, we just can't pay any more than X and be within the confines. So if Trump doesn't do something like lift those regulations and allow someone to make $4 or $5 more an hour and work in a dairy, or put out some work visas for the dairy industry, but he just closes the wall.
Well, but the thing about the wall, though, apart from it being symbolic, is the getting everybody out of the pool. I mean, to use right. a goofy analogy, it's like, okay, we got to get everybody out of the pool so we can figure out who ought to be in the pool.
Right.
So I think that if he's the businessman that I think he would be, is that the idea of the wall, apart from the symbolic nature of it,
mm-hmm.
Is the reality of, okay, we just need to stop until we can figure things out.
Right.
The whole immigration thing is so out of control. People are coming in that may not ought to be here because they want to kill us.
Right.
Or they're coming in to exploit our country as opposed to contributing to the country.
Right.
Or all of the – I mean, you have both sides of the equation. Not all immigrants are terrorists, but not all of them are also benevolent and seek good things for us and for our country.
Well,
the middle ground is, if you do the wall, if you do the blow the whistle, get everybody out right. of the pool, so that we can stop and say, now, how do we sensibly allow people to come into the country?
Right.
How do we figure out the dairy thing? How do we figure out what the needs are, and then who we let in to come meet those needs, and then welcome them in, as opposed to the
right.
border-free sensibility, like just throw it all over, because, again, among those who think that way, they tend not to think in terms of the fallenness of man and the fact that we are prone to corruption and certain things like that. It's all good. With the right education, right. everybody's just good. Let's just open the doors and let everybody in, because they're all good.
Is this mercy, though, to say we're going to kind of protect the border? We're definitely going to shut the border down at Tijuana and the different official points. So any place that you could safely come through in a car, you can't come through.
But you can, though. I mean, I think they are going to keep those. I mean, they're going to
– No, what I'm saying is that
– they're going to look at them and determine who can come through and in what way.
Any change to the status quo has been kind of been deemed as unmerciful with
right.
us, you know, building this wall. But what does the wall stop? The wall stops – some desperate human being from Mexico paying a coyote $3,000 to be drugged through the desert in the middle of the night and possibly exploited or raped or something along the way. And so that's what the wall stops. Now,
what also stops people who are trying to come in illegally, who are not victims, they actually
right.
want to come in and exploit our country and do terrible things here.
Or
it's both sides of the equation.
Running drugs from Mexico
yeah.
and stuff like that. And
yeah.
and also, not to mention the fact that we know for a fact, no one talks about it, but we know for a fact that they have found all kinds of evidence that there are people that are from nowhere near Mexico, but are from the Middle East
right.
coming through our southern border.
Right.
Now, why in the world?
And that's the other concern, by the way.
Why would you want, if you are from Pakistan or mm-hmm. whatever, you're from Iraq, why would you come through the southern border as opposed to not just getting a travel visa to visit America and then disappear. Because then we would at least know you're here and that you didn't leave.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be here and completely anonymous. Well, that just, I'm sorry. I think we've gotten to a place where having people in our country that are completely anonymous and no one knows they're here, why they're here, where they're from, it's just not really much of an option anymore. And if that makes us xenophobic, then fine. But I think the other question is that I have friends in California that I used to work with in a kitchen that are undocumented immigrants, illegal aliens.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to one of them one time and I was like, so what's your take on this? He goes, dude, I don't want to be here.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, I'm from Michoacan. The place where I live is beautiful. I have a family there. I would much rather be there. I would come up here seasonally if it wasn't so hard to get through.
Right.
He's like, but look, there's no work there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like a bunch of drug cartels, six or seven families and a corrupt government running everything. So my options are watch my family starve, pick up a gun and try to cause a revolution, get us all killed, or hop the border and work in this kitchen and miss my family. So I take three.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so there's the difference between the modern kind of immigrant that we're seeing with the border and the old Irish coming through Ellis Island and Italians and all those people. They were coming to America, looking at that Statue of Liberty, the place of opportunity and promise, and they want to come here and be part of that. People that are mostly from Mexico and Central America are like, they're running from something so much worse.
Mm-hmm.
Or they've been pushed into a corner that this is their only option.
Well, and that's always the difficulty when we talk about just, let's call them refugees, just as a catch-all.
Right.
People in need.
They are kind of economic refugees.
So let's just call them refugees as a catch-all for people who are trying to come here because their circumstances where they were is so bad. And this is opportunity for them. And they don't want to come in and do anything other than work, make some money, support their families back home.
Right.
Or whatever the case may be. And how we handle that, of course, some of us would argue, how we handle those once we can validate that those are the situations, how we handle that, it says a lot about us as a nation, where we show mercy. And also, what's the most effective way to help them? And that's the other thing when we talk about helping refugees, bringing them here may not be the most effective thing for them. Figuring out how to help them where they are might be the most effective thing for them. Mm-hmm. Stabilizing their country. How do we help Mexico if we can deal with the drug cartels or whatever the case may be? But then that even gets into another discussion about tax dollars being used to help other countries when we have people in this country who are starving, who need work. Who need
that being said, I mean, I think that there's room for if your neighbor's house is falling down and when it goes, it's going to fall into your house, then it's self-interest to go next door and help them kind of shore up their house or pay to trim their trees if the limb's going to fall on your house.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we're kind of in that situation with Mexico. We have an increasingly untenable situation happening just right next door.
Right.
And so we have to, I think that.
But what happens when your neighbor doesn't want you to help them?
Right.
Their house is going to fall over and hit your house, and you want to actually go over and do things, but it's going to require some things of them that they don't want to do.
They just want to send their kids over to your house to eat all the time
exactly.
and just do homework because it's quiet there or whatever. It's like it's like at some point you have to go, okay, look, you're welcome to kind of come take part in what we're doing, and that's cool. Hey, we want to be a good neighbor, but at some point we have to kind of sit down and have an honest talk about, you know, what, you know,
what's
going
reasonable.
On, what's going on over there? What is that smell?
And
what is
what
that
happens
sound?
If you're, and your neighbor isn't reasonable? I mean, this is the difficulty. I mean, the human dynamic of this whole situation is what's so difficult about it, because for every side that you take, which is everybody wants to do us harm, or no, they're just good people who need help.
Right.
All the variations are the complexity and the nuance of the situation. But people in sound bites don't like to talk about nuance. People when they're protesting don't deal with nuance.
All right.
People when they get angry, it's just done.
All right. Well, we got to go to the break, and when we get back, I got we're going to switch gears completely off politics. You're listening to The Counter Position. I'm your host, Andrew Whaley.
Lynn, how we crave a hanging in the dark.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
People singing, please don't stay, but please don't go.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, so I'm still here with Paul McCusker, and evidently I have a bad influence on Paul McCusker. I made him miss Mass. I got him talking about stuff. I made him miss Mass. You get to sit here and be a pagan with me.
That's it.
You know, it's a daily Mass is a good thing, but it can become superstitious if you think that that's like, oh, no.
Well, and it, but talk is like crack cocaine to me. So
it absolutely,
it's a hobby.
It is for me too.
It's like there's.
This is kind of me and Mark Gieschek have that over the counter podcast. Mm-hmm. And it started for the reason it's called over the counter is it literally took place over the counter. Mm-hmm. He would just come in and we would have these conversations you and I are having, and people started kind of pulling up a chair and listening. Mm-hmm. And so we started recording them, and then it was too loud in the cafe. So we went someplace else and we ended up with this podcast. Right? Mm. Because it was just enjoyable. And it's funny, you're another one that, like, you and I could do a podcast. Yeah. It's like you and I, you come into shop and you and I sit and do this for free.
Well, and I thought about this. A friend of mine in England said that we were talking for hours on it, and he just said, it's very nice to meet somebody else who likes talking and conversation as a hobby. And I'd never thought of it that way, but I thought it's true. I gravitate towards certain things, music and yeah. I like movies, and but I do like good conversation.
Dialogue. Dialectic, just kind of pleasant talk, pleasant conversation, even speeches, even, you know, rhetoric. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, you and I are both reaver or both converts. I'm a reaver, you're a convert, but we both understand that one thing that I really miss as a Catholic is great homiletics. Mm-hmm. There's something so pleasurable about the rhetoric and the movement of a great sermon, mm-hmm. you know? And I kind of put, you know, sermons, good speeches, but definitely a whole nother level is conversation. Conversation right. is absolutely like crack to me.
Yeah.
I can't get enough of it.
Yep. All exactly.
Right. Okay. I got to throw some of that at you.
Okay.
Okay. So I see two things at once, and I see something in common in them and stuff. It's over the weekend. I was sitting in line for confession, and, I forgot to bring a book in, and I left my phone in the car. So I grabbed Merton's New Seeds of Contemplation off the shelf in this bookstore and was reading it while I was in the line. And I hadn't read that first chapter that he added to that in a long time. It is so beautiful. I need to go back and buy another copy of it. But he said, he talks about contemplation. At some point, he says that it's the realization of an infinite being at the depths of my finite being, that you tap in and you realize, oh, underneath I'm contingent. Mm. I am a spring. I'm that piece of water going down a little river that is connected to this deep aquifer. That's the way Jazani talks about it. Is this? I am my source. I am that which I don't know, but I'm so connected to it that I know that it's there. And then it's what's funny. So that's one idea. But then I was flipping through Netflix looking for something to watch while I was going to sleep the other night, and they keep trying to get me to watch The Magicians. Mm. And I hadn't watched it yet. And it's kind of The Breakfast Club meets Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Meets, you know, some modern kind of like horror, you know.
Yeah, my wife started to watch that, and I couldn't get from her whether she was enjoying it. I wandered through for various scenes, and I couldn't quite tell exactly what was going on.
I've watched
occasionally
two.
It was a lot of yelling and a lot of intensity.
I've watched two of them. I don't know if I'm going to go any farther with it, but there was this really great moment, and I think that you and I'll you'll get where I'm going with this. There's this really great moment where he's talking, he's about to be thrown out of the school, and they're going to wipe his mind and send him back. Mm. And he's trying to find a way to remember that there's magic, that magic's real, because he finds out that magic is real. And there he's training him to be a magician. And then he knows that they wipe your mind when they put you out of the school. And he's talking to someone, and he says, once you realize that magic's real, you can't go back. Mm-hmm. There's nothing else. Mm-hmm. It's like seeing in color and then choosing to go back to black and white. Mm-hmm. And I kind of think that there's something about that with like religion and conversion
I mean, it's what immediately came to mind as you said that was, of course, John chapter 8, where Jesus is talking about body and blood, and they're going, you're a cannibal, and all these people are walking away. And then he turns to the disciples, Peter and the gang, and said, so are you going to leave me too? And Peter said, well, where are we going to go? You have the words of life.
Right.
And in that, it's that sense of, once I've tasted this,
right,
once I've experienced this, there is no going back. How do I go back?
Right.
Go back to what? I mean, it makes me sympathetic to the men who walked on the moon, you know, and some of them suffered depression, and there are others that they do this thing, whatever the thing is, and then they go back to normal life, and then what happens? And the thing about, of course, our faith is there is no going back, really.
Right.
In fact, I don't even know that God ever really lets us go back. If the hound of heaven idea is true, even if we try to, he is constantly pursuing us and often reminding us of what we've left behind if we try to walk away or whatever it may be. But that is fascinating that you would bring that up, because I was thinking about that the other day. Of even this. Okay, I come from, you know, an evangelical background. I become Catholic.
Right.
And the things that frustrate me, the question came up from a friend of mine who just said, well, you know, what would be next? I mean, if you weren't Catholic, as if I have an option.
Right.
And I honestly, I can't even conceive what it would be. It's like, once I've experienced this and once I'm in it,
right,
I would either have to give up my faith completely, just determine there is no God and it's all myth, or I don't know, just go back to the evangelical thing of just making up my own, you know, doing a house church and it's just me.
I tried to do that. I mean, like in 2006, I quit.
Yeah.
I just woke up one day and I just didn't believe anymore. I just woke up. I mean, it was a bunch of mornings I woke up. And it kept getting worse and worse, and over months and months. And one day I just woke up and I was sitting there having coffee and I went, wait a minute. So there's this thing that has no beginning, that has three parts, but they're not really parts, the persons, but it's one God. And the second one of those things we're not going to call parts, who's a person, came and was like in Galilee and like wore sandals and peed on the side of the road and ate fish and you know, had a backache. And got himself killed by the Romans. But hey, don't worry. He resurrected from the dead. And because of that, I can carry these magic wooden beads in my pocket that I used to talk to his mom.
Mm-hmm.
How can I own an iPhone and believe that?
Yeah.
You know, and I tried to quit. I tried. I really did. And I tried to turn into kind of this, I never was tempted towards atheism. But I kind of tried to turn this, you know, this Rob Bell Buddhist, you know, kind of a, the Christian story and
it's
the narrative.
All cool, whatever it is.
And I'm like, yeah, but there's so much other stuff. And I couldn't do it. He wouldn't leave me alone. And I finally just ended up coming back around and going, okay, I'm just going to rectify myself with the fact that once you know this, once you've experienced it, you can't be the same afterwards.
Right.
And if you can be the same afterwards, then you didn't encounter it.
Yeah. Well, see, and it's worse for me because the option of not believing doesn't seem to be part of how I'm wired.
Right.
When somebody asked me, when did you start believing in God? And I've always believed in God.
Right.
I mean, there is no point in my life when I can track a change. In fact, what's more absurd is not only have I always believed in God, but I also believe that for whatever reason, he loved me. I mean, that's crazy.
I think it makes perfect sense.
But, well, and I kept thinking, okay, so he does exist. That he doesn't exist is not even in my thinking. An option of walking away is never really there because I'm thinking, and walk away from what and go where? There is nowhere else to go.
Right.
He's everywhere. So even if I tried, I just don't think that I could because my mind always goes back to, but he exists and he loves me. And maybe that's a form of narcissism. I don't even know what that is, except from the youngest age, that's what I thought.
Well, it's funny. This is
just flows on.
This is part of what I was thinking about. It's funny you walked in today. Part of what I was thinking about is this shows up in your writing. Because I think like horror and like kind of like science fiction, fear kind of based, kind of like supernatural stuff is a great place to see that. Because there is something kind of in common. Between having real religious conversion, really encountering the reality of the supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
And like that moment in the horror movie when you look down the hallway and there's the ghost walking towards you and you turn and close your eyes and shake your head
mm-hmm.
and you look back and it's still there.
Mm-hmm.
Because every other time in the movie it's disappeared, but you're right. Like, oh no, I didn't, that wasn't my mind playing tricks on me.
It's real.
It's real. Yeah. That did just happen. And I think mm-hmm. I've had, anybody who's been a Christian for a while has had moments of like providence that were just so far beyond coincidence,
mm-hmm.
so far beyond, so infinite in their meaning and which kind of do that usual suspects close at the end of the movie where you now look back and you realize what was going on all along. And it's like, it's so rich.
Mm-hmm.
And you go, oh gosh, it's real.
Well, why do we even look for meaning? I mean,
right.
I mean, this spins off into a whole other conversation, but I don't know that any other species is constantly looking for meaning in terms of their existence, but we look for meaning. Why do we look for meaning in what others would dismiss as coincidence?
Right.
Why do we look for meaning in little things as well as the big things, except to go back to the great saints who always said, but that's because we're wired that way.
Right.
There's that part of us that's constantly looking for God, whether we realize we're looking for him or not. And all the while, he's looking for us.
Right.
And that's the thing about not knowing where to go. Because ultimately, to go into this sort of fatalistic void
mm-hmm.
of, let's say, pure atheism, which mm-hmm. just says meaning is only what I bring to my life
right.
and how I interact with others and being a good person by whatever rules that is,
mm-hmm.
Are my grandma went off, but and I think I'm constantly exploring that in the books, in horror. The thing about the supernatural.
Okay, hold on. Let's talk about. We're going to the end of the break, and when we get back, I want to talk about horror and the supernatural a little bit. You're listening to The Counterposition. I am your host, Andrew Whaley. I'm here with my guest, Paul McCusker, who I've snagged and made mismatched. We'll be back in a second.
Then all the color glass, that painter's palette smash. All the colors of my soul.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counterposition, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
I'm a hyena laughing fool. I'm a hero without anyone to save. Love decked myself in toys. I'm a poor and kingly boy. Oh, I'm lovely. Oh, I'm lovely. And I'm dull.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right. We are here with my impromptu guest, Paul McCusker. I never introduced you. I mean, I'm just assuming that my listeners know who you are, but he's Adventures in Odyssey fame, one of the founders, but you came in right after.
I worked on it early on, yeah.
Yeah, you're the guy behind Adventures in Odyssey, basically, focus on the family. And,
yeah.
And the author of The Body Under the Bridge.
Yeah,
and
Father Gilbert Mysteries, yeah.
Yeah, what's the new one called?
It's called Death in the Shadows. Yeah. So we were talking about mystery. I mean, about supernatural.
Wait, before we go on, we got to do a shout out. Who's your friend to focus on the family?
Oh, Rob Huntrod.
Rob
Huntrod. Yeah.
Shout out.
He's a big fan.
Shout out to Rob.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
I want to get him up here for lunch. So you guys can actually meet.
That'd be
a
blast. So that's so funny.
We'll figure that out. So Rob, this
randomly
is on
randomly a friend of yours is a listener to my show.
Oh, yeah.
I always wonder who's out there listening. I beg people to email me, tell me they're listening, but I have the least responsive audience in the entire world of radio.
Yeah.
Supernatural.
Okay, so real quick. The thing about it is we were talking about the love of God and about – and that's the thing that always drives me crazy when I'm watching a secular movie dealing with the supernatural.
Right.
When they see ghosts or there's some supernatural force coming after them and they shoot at it or they're yelling at it. And I keep thinking how hopeless it is because – without God, and even more so without the sacraments,
right.
How do you fight these things? I remember there was a novel for kids about this boy who knew that there were vampires in the town, and he didn't know what to do about it, and no adult would listen to him. And he was walking down the street with his friend, and he said, okay, that's it. I'm going to go over here in this Catholic church and talk to them about it. And the friend said, "You're not Catholic. Why would you go there?" And he said, "Because they're the only ones who would know how to fight it. They're the only ones with the weapons." I said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Well, if I go over to the Baptist church, what are they going to do? Throw tracts at them?"
Well, there was
have the sacrament.
There was a great meme going around that had like this red background and like this sketchy, you know, like the priest from The Exorcist or something. And it said, "Everybody wants to make fun of the Catholic Church until you get a demon in your
That's
house."
Right.
And then it's
right.
Like, "Oh, Father, can you come over?
That's right.
I got a crazy idea. Why did you invite me over for dinner? Want to have some conversation before you had a demon in your house?" No, man, everybody liked the Catholic Church when you got a demon. You know?
It's funny. I mean, it's the emergency room phenomenon. But and for me, that's the thing about the supernatural. My interest in the paranormal and the supernatural and ghosts. And Father Gilbert himself says there are a lot more ghost stories than there are actual ghosts. So the manifestations, we're not running rampant with them. But I love to explore that reality because of then the Christian spiritual reality on the other side of it. That it isn't, I mean, when you read Screwtape Letters and when you read these things, that sense of a hierarchy of order on both sides is fascinating to
right.
me, and what that order might be. So Malachi Martin's Hostage to the Devil, which when you look at the five case studies, you realize
I've never read that.
There is a hierarchy going on, and C.S. Lewis got it right.
Yeah.
In terms of the hierarchy going on in Screwtape as well, though he made it bureaucratic,
right.
which is suitable. But I mean, that side of it is
fascinating.
Which
I think
to
it
me.
Probably is.
Yeah, it's that feeling of there's a lot more going on. I mean, the idea of if we could punch through the wall
right.
of the set of this stage and see
right.
everything that's beyond. And I think I've always had that nagging feeling
well,
that there is something beyond.
When you see these horror movies, I think that you see these horror movies where for a moment, like, you know, what was that one movie? Was it 13 Ghosts, I think it was?
Yeah, I actually haven't seen that.
You put the goggles on, and now that you can see him, and it's like, you know, that trope's been used in a lot of horror movies where the room looks fine, and then it's like you put the goggles on, and you can see all these things. You know, it's like if you could just have those goggles on, it's interesting. If you could wear those goggles all the time, would life be livable on one side? But then on the other side, you know, it's kind of like it's like the misfit at the end of A Good Man Is Hard to Find in Flannery O'Connor when he says, "Oh, she'd have been a good woman if she'd had someone to hold a gun to her head all her life." You know, if you're kind of like keeping that eternal bigger picture in mind all the
but
time.
But it's fear-based. See, that's the concern.
That's the problem, yeah.
If it's fear-based, that's not a motivator. I mean, it's funny that a lot of people use fear tactics to try to get people to God, and yet God himself, I never see him, and I'm never aware of him doing. He talks about consequence. I remember with my son when he was little, and I used to say, "Well, son, if you do this and this is going to happen, well, why are you always trying to scare me?" And I would say, "Son, I'm not trying to scare you. I'm just telling you this is called consequence.
If you jump
I'm not using this
roof,
to get you to do something else. I just want you to be aware that if you do this, this is what could
if
happen.
If I say you jump off the roof, you're going to break your leg, I'm not threatening to break your leg. I'm trying to
I'm
teach you, how gravity works.
Yeah.
I'm
so
telling
when
you about
says,
reality.
God
you know?
Says if you do it this way, then these are the things that will happen. If you do it this other way, these are the things that will happen. And yet we know we are motivated by love ultimately, or ought to be.
Right.
Our relationship with him is supposed to be love-based, not fear-based.
Right.
Healthy respect is part of it. And I think there's an element of fear within the healthy respect, as you would with anybody that you respect.
No, it's interesting. I'd like to get your take on them because you've written about this and you're writing fiction books I'm trying to pick an example from the first book because I have a galley of the second book, but I don't think it's out yet, is it?
No, it's out.
Oh, is it out?
Yeah,
okay.
You can get it.
So
I should have brought it into
you did. You brought me one.
Okay.
You brought me one before it was out. But,
okay.
One of the opening scenes in the new book when there's that woman that's been drowned and she's like hanging in midair and all that, he's always seeing these dead people.
Right.
Right. You know, kind of like Sixth Sense style almost.
Right.
And it's like, what's interesting, I remember hearing a priest tell a story. He was actually in a talk at a conference about the importance of guardian angels. And he was talking about, as Catholics, we kind of see these two things. So this guy, He goes, he's a priest. He goes to bed. He wakes up in the middle of the night and he's, this is a true story, you know, and he sees a guy standing at the end of his bed when he wakes up in like a long coat, like a trench coat and kind of a hat. And he's just sitting there and he does it kind of black, no face. He can't see him. And the priest just has this feeling and he just looks at the guy and he says, do you need a mass head for you? And the head bobs up and down. He can see the hat move. And then, you know, he goes back to sleep. A couple hours later, he wakes up, standing at the foot of his bed is a Latino looking guy in a green soccer uniform with a hole blown right through the middle of it, like Sixth Sense style. Mm-hmm. Right. And he says, do you need a mass said for you? And the guy just nods and disappears. And then later on that night, he wakes up again and there's this woman standing at the edge of his bed and she's kind of seductive looking and kind of like in a negligee or something. Mm-hmm. And she's bending over him like she's going to kiss him. And all of a sudden she just transforms into this horrible thing and tries mm-hmm. to like get him. And he says, guardian angel help. And she just sucked backwards, like into a pinpoint, like a vortex, right. Like gone. Now he wakes up the next day, picks up the newspaper and there's an article about this guy in some Central American football team blew a shot that cost him like the championship like that. Oh. And a fan walked on the field and with a sawed off shotgun and blew a hole through the middle mm-hmm. of it. And that had happened like 2 days before.
Right.
So yeah. The fact that we as Catholics believe that there is kind of this thing purgatory,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, Satan knows that reality and will try to imitate it.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense of ghosts and demons and kind of the confusion between the two? And you write this as fiction, but what do you think about this as a theologian?
Well, I think it's funny. What I love about writing fiction is it's all speculative. So where the right. theologians don't agree, then I can do lots of things.
It's so much more fun. It's more fun.
And it's true because, I mean, the more ancient view was that if it was a ghost, it was demonic. It wasn't going to be some manifestation of anything right. good. And yet you have the appearance of Samuel in the Old Testament appearing to Saul and being rather annoyed for having been awakened. And so that side of it is fascinating to me because there are a lot of unanswered questions about the order of the unseen
right.
world and why credible people do see some things. But the one thing I keep in mind, though, is – and I think most theologians do – and priests, if they see a manifestation, the first thing you do is, like Paul said, test the spirits. I mean, you want to test
right.
to make sure that this is the real deal as opposed to a counterfeit because Satan is the great counterfeiter.
Right.
And he's going to imitate anything, no matter what it is, in order to devour us, to lead us astray.
Right. Look at like mental illness. People are illness of some kind. People go, well, they thought that they were demoniacs back then because they didn't know about epilepsy or they didn't know about bipolar right. or schizophrenia. I have a friend who had went nuts, but he was a saint and he went nuts the way a saint went.
Yeah.
You know, it's like as if the religious world stops somehow when mental illness comes in,
right.
as if like somehow the devil in his hatred, he would go, oh, well, he doesn't matter because he's crazy. I won't torment or use him.
Yeah.
Well, no, he's even more vulnerable.
Yeah, the symptoms of it. And again, that's part of the masquerade is the idea that he'll mimic symptoms, of course.
He'll mimic anything.
He is always on the edge. And it's funny, in the Father Gilbert books, I usually try to keep everything on the explainable edge.
Right.
That if you really, and I think that's true with a lot of things, like, you know, parting the Red Sea and the theologian, it was the Reed Sea, it was whatever it was. And that's the thing. He always stays on the edge of the explainable.
Right.
And then there's the question of faith. Well, which side are you going to fall on with, I believe this was a miracle, or no, I can explain it away.
Right.
Well, Satan plays that game as well. I mean, he's constantly working on the edge, and that's part of his disguise, so that we don't pinpoint him and we don't recognize that he's there.
Well, speaking of the edge, we are on the edge of this show.
Okay,
Paul, thanks so much for for coming out.
I hope people won't make a connection though between us starting with Trump and ending with satanic activity. But there is no connection there.
Quad scripsy. All right, thanks, Paul. Let's pull the plug, pop the cork on another episode of The Counterposition. Thanks for coming out.
I'll take your place. My- stone. I'll take your place, marble stone.